Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, Wyoming plans to build what would be the country's largest wind farm, but is facing the question of how it would send all that clean energy to customers in other states.
But first, Ukrainian and Russian diplomats met today in Belarus, which borders both countries, in the hopes of reaching an immediate ceasefire agreement. But over the weekend, Russian President Putin called for talks on granting statehood to eastern Ukraine. And while Russian officials continue to deny they've invaded the country, and White House officials called reports of Russian troops in Ukraine an incursion, there were more calls over the weekend to help Ukraine. Here's Senator John McCain on CBS's Face the Nation.
For God's sake, can't we help these people defend themselves? This is not an incursion. This is an invasion.
NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson is in Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine. Hi, Soraya.
Hi, Robin.
And tell us about these talks in Minsk in Belarus today. Are both sides looking for a ceasefire?
Well, that's certainly the aim. The people who are meeting are, I would say, medium-level people from Russia, from Ukraine, as well as separatist leaders, which is something that is being met with a wide amount of criticism here in Ukraine. The feeling is that that's giving them credibility that they don't deserve. I see on the Donetsk People Republic's website, and Donetsk People's Republic, of course, is one of the regions here that has self-proclaimed itself, independent, shall we say, from Ukraine. Their deputy prime minister is in Minsk. And what he's going to be asking for, it's actually surprising in the sense that he says that they will agree to be part of a united Ukraine. However, they want amnesty for all the separatists. They also want to have an economic union with Russia. And they want to be able to do their own elections, pick their own leaders, judges, prosecutors, and the like. So it doesn't seem that that's necessarily going to go over very well with the leadership in Kiev. I should mention that also at this meeting are representatives of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. They have been the international monitors here, trying to oversee this process and bridge gaps, if you will, and try and help lead these groups to a ceasefire.
Yeah. And by the way, you're there in Mariupol in the east. Kiev in the west, of course, backs the government. You are where this, in the area where this fighting and pro-Russian sentiment is. What is the thinking there about a ceasefire?
Well, Mariupol until last week really wasn't on the front, if you will. The fighting was mostly in the border areas between Ukraine and Russia to the east and to the north of here in Donetsk and Luhansk. And then suddenly the rebels were able to make some serious progress. According to Ukraine, it's because there has been a large influx of Russian armaments. Russia, of course, denies that, as you mentioned. The rebel forces have taken over some villages and towns, strategic ones, only about 30 miles away from this port city, which is a very important industrial town as well. But people here seem to be very united in wanting to be part of Ukraine, as frightened as they are. Today, schools started across the country, and Mariupol was one of the few places in the east where kids were actually going to school. And the school we went to, the teachers were encouraging them to sing patriotic Ukrainian songs, defying, if you will, these rebels who are encamped a short distance from here.
Well, tell us more about this mood there on this day as some kids go back to school, because as you report, there was fighting, an all-night fight with pro-Russian rebels sending Ukrainian troops fleeing from the airport in the city of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. But fighting seems to have slowed today. Why is that?
Well, the date is an anniversary of when Germany invaded Poland. And there's a lot of sensitivity here in this country. They call World War II the Great Patriotic War. Nobody wants to be seen as doing something that would be then linked back to what Hitler did back in 1939 when he invaded Poland.
And let's remind people, the Soviets invaded Poland from the east just days after the Nazis invaded Poland from the west.
Yes. Well, I don't think that will be much talked about, certainly right. on the part of the Russian-backed separatists. In fact, these Eastern Ukrainians here, you know, the ones who are supporting the separatists, they are convinced that the people in Kiev are all a bunch of fascists and Nazis and that sort of thing. So there's a real sensitivity to that. But there was a sense that there would be some calm today. There, of course, were major flare-ups, as you mentioned, the area near the airport of Luhansk. This is an area that Ukrainian troops had taken that was very important to cutting off the alleged supply line to Russia, you know, taking this southern road, if you will. And it seems now that the rebels have taken it back. The Ukrainian forces are leaving, being pushed out. Also, what happened yesterday that was very distressing to the Ukrainians, they say that one of their patrol boats and border patrol boats was shelled and capsized. Two of its crew members are missing off the coast of Mariupol here.
Yeah. Well, but so I guess what you're saying, though, is that there's more quiet today because of this whiff of history. And we understand that, you know, history is a big factor in what's happening today in Ukraine.
Absolutely. I mean, the two regions that have declared themselves separate or, you know, seceded from Ukraine are now joining together to form what they're calling New Russia. And that, of course, has its history back in the 18th century. It was conquered by Russia, this large swath of this country and other areas. And it was called New Russia. It was ruled by Imperial Russia until the Bolshevik Revolution around that time. And now what's happening is that they're trying to create a new Russia, at least, new Russia, if you will. That's certainly what one of the rebel commanders I spoke to on the outskirts of the town here, not far from Mariupol, what he said explained to me that, you know, they're going to create this place and they would like it to be with Russian help. But he claimed, just as the Russians do, that they're not getting any help and that all the modern equipment that I saw and modern, you know, uniforms and upgraded Kalashnikov guns, that these were all things that they had captured from Ukrainian forces.
NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson in Mariupol in Ukraine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here in this country, the residents of Saratoga, Wyoming, have just 10 days left to voice their opinion on the environmental impact of a new 1,000-turbine wind farm. And if the Chokecherry and Sierra Madre wind energy projects gets final approval, it would become the largest wind farm in the country. But since Wyoming has an abundance of energy, the company is looking to sell the wind-generated power to other states. And for now, there's no infrastructure in place to do that. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports on why transmission gridlocks are keeping so much western wind at bay.
Shiny white blades slice through the clear Wyoming sky. The sun is blinding, and the sound.
Woo! It is windy!
Well, the wind's coming around the turbine now.
Lane Anderson is a project manager with PacifiCorp, the utility company that owns High Plains Wind Farm.
Wyoming is an excellent producer of wind every day, day in and day out.
It blows hard and often, sometimes ripping through these high elevation plains at 60 miles an hour, and sometimes taking my hard hat with it.
Oh.
This farm is small, just 66 turbines, and most of its electricity is consumed right here in Wyoming. Compare that to the Chokecherry project, where a proposed 1,000 wind turbines would generate electricity for the West Coast. In theory, University of Wyoming professor Rob Godby compares it to real estate.
We have a great house and a relatively poor location.
Because Wyoming has powerful wind resources, but it's far away from the states that need more energy.
In order to overcome that location, we have to build transmission lines, and they're expensive.
$3 billion expensive. That's the projected cost of Transwest Express, the transmission line that would carry some of Chokecherry's power 725 miles to a station in Nevada. Both projects are backed by the Anschutz Corporation, a Denver-based energy conglomerate. In order to build their transmission line, Anschutz will have to cut through a lot of backyards.
People don't like change. They move to particular places for a reason. They like where they are. And if you come in and say, this is what we're going to do for the good of the rest of the country, you know, in some ways they're sacrificing.
One of those sacrificing is Wyoming rancher Niels Hansen. He drives me up over a fiery red rim to get a better look at his land.
Oh, wow.
Can you get that back east?
Utah-based Rocky Mountain Power is planning a different long-distance transmission line, one that Chokecherry could also use to transport its electricity.
Gateway West, we're almost underneath it. It's going to be running from east to west.
Right across this property. And Hansen has been fighting it since the first letter arrived.
I wrote him back and said, you're not welcome on our property. Stay off until you give me specifics of where you want to go, what you want to do.
That didn't work. Hansen says the transmission company could have built on his property anyway by claiming eminent domain. Now, he seems resigned to the fact that the line will probably be built. I asked him what he thinks it will look like.
A worst nightmare?
Private landowners slow down the process, and so do the feds, because two-thirds of TransWest will cross federal land. Beverly Gorney of Wyoming's Bureau of Land Management says they'll have to issue a record of decision, then grant a right of way, then a notice to proceed.
But we are not the only entity that they have to deal with in terms of getting this up and built and going.
There's also Utah, Colorado, Nevada, and environmental interests.
So they have many, many I's to dot and T's to cross before they can actually break ground.
So essentially, this wind farm and its transmission lines are one gigantic bet on future energy policies and demands. TransWest sounds optimistic. They're, quote, very advanced in the federal environmental analysis process, unquote. And Rob Godby of the University of Wyoming says the combination of the Obama administration's push to reduce emissions and states' renewable energy mandates all mean transmission from Wyoming to the Western grid could be incredibly profitable.
And that's really the bottom line. Like anything else, that remains to be seen. So it is a gamble.
And a long-term gamble at that. TransWest Express has been under development since 2005, and if approved, it likely won't be online for at least 2 to 3 more years. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson in Wyoming.
And Lee's story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. It is Labor Day, of course, so you may be thinking about barbecue. Although, what do you really know about barbecue? Probably not as much as Daniel Vaughn, who's written a book called The Prophets of Smoked Meat, A Journey Through Texas Barbecue. What about barbecue in other places, you might ask? Well, I asked him that too when we spoke last summer, and it was clear that in his view, the best barbecue in Texas is the best barbecue in the world.
That's right. Well, we're in Texas. We take our barbecue pretty seriously. We think we've got the best barbecue anywhere in the country. And we think that the best barbecue anywhere is in this country. So if we've got the best barbecue in the country, it must be the best barbecue in the world.
Well, what is it that they do in Texas that they just don't do anywhere else, or that maybe we couldn't do at our own backyard barbecue?
Well, you can do anything in a backyard barbecue if you have the time and patience and you actually buy a smoker. But, you know, brisket and beef ribs, beef sausages, those are things that define Texas barbecue. Brisket is one of the hardest muscles to cook. Beef short ribs are just full of sinew and collagen and take forever to break down. Hmm. But when you get them right, they're one of the greatest bites of meat you can put in your mouth. And then sausages, house-made sausages are just one of those things that you have sausage traditions all across the country. But as far as sausage being specifically associated with barbecue, Texas is unique in that way.
Now, I want to get to Texas barbecue and all the intricacies of it in a second. But first, I want to just define the terms here, and maybe you can help me out with this. So in Memphis, the barbecue that people know from Memphis, whether it's Central Barbecue or Rendezvous, it's kind of usually a dry rub, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be baby back ribs, and it's going to have a dry rub, usually a rub put on while it's cooking, and then a rub to finish it when it's done.
And in Carolina, they are famous for their vinegary sauce.
That's right, also known as the Vinegar State. Eastern North Carolina has its whole hog traditions and a white, clear vinegar sauce. And then over in Western North Carolina, it's a very similar vinegar sauce, but they have the addition of ketchup in there as well. Hmm. And they only smoke shoulders rather than doing whole hog.
Now, Kansas City is famous for the sauce being thick and sweet with like molasses in it, right?
That's right. They're also the pioneer in the as far as putting burnt ends on the menu, kind of crusty, fatty end bits of the brisket.
And then Kentucky, I guess, is the last kind of famous one that besides Texas, of course. And they are well known for using mutton.
Yeah, in the Owensboro area, there's several barbecue joints there that serve mutton.
That's Old Sheep, right?
Yeah, it's got a little bit gamier flavor. It's a tougher meat, which is probably why they smoke it for so long and then dip it in a very Worcestershire-heavy dip.
Now, let's leave Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida out, because in your map of the American barbecue, you say just God only knows what they have. So I want to get to Texas, which is very filled with all kinds of different barbecues. The one that I guess most people would know is the East Texas style, right?
Yeah, the East Texas style is closer to your southern style of barbecue. Ribs covered in a pretty thick sauce. The ribs are cooked to they're really tender and almost falling off the bone. The brisket is the same way, usually cooked to very tender and more often served as a chopped beef sandwich with sauce on it rather than simple sliced beef of central Texas.
What about the other kinds in Texas? There's a lot of them.
Yeah, well, so we talked about East Texas. Then if you go over to Central Texas, you're talking about meat market style. And that is meats that are cut in front of you on a big cutting block that are served on butcher paper. You take them over to a picnic table, and usually the only utensil you've got is your hands and a plastic knife. That is all about simple seasoning of the meat. Usually salt and pepper is about as far as they go. Many of the places there do it low and slow. So,
what does that mean, low and slow?
It's long cooking times at a low temperature.
And when you say long cooking times, what are we talking about, hours?
Well, if you go to a place like Franklin Barbecue, the total cooking time for a brisket is about 18 hours.
Wow. And you say that when smoking meat, it's really more about tending to the fire than tending to the meat.
Yeah, that's right. If you're constantly opening up the cooking chamber and poking and prodding the meat and mopping and basting, that's really not the Texas way. And also, it's all about getting good quality smoke. You want a clean white or blue smoke. You don't want a dark, thick smoke coming out of there. That is smoke that's going to leave some pretty nasty deposits on your meat.
Now, I have to say I consider myself a lover of barbecue, but your book really knocks me down a peg, because I was so excited when I went to Austin to go to the Salt Lick Barbecue, which everyone says is great, and I loved it. You describe it as the most well-known Texas barbecue in New York, and you say it draws the ire of most every seasoned smoke meat fanatic.
It does. I think the Salt Lick does good barbecue, so I don't want to be misunderstood there. I think the Salt Lick is both the most underrated and overrated barbecue in Texas. I think they put out good smoked meat. I think a lot of people who come in from out of town, they go to the Salt Lick, and for good reason they love it. You're out under the trees, you've got to wait for your table a while, and you usually spend that time with your friends and a cooler of beer. If we're all being honest with ourselves, the Salt Lick doesn't put out anything terrible. They are serving way, way too many people to put out the best of the best barbecue in Texas.
Well, Daniel, Texas Monthly's Best Barbecue List comes out every 5 years. It is considered the barbecue Bible in Texas. So what is the number one place on that list, and what is so great about it?
Well, that would be Franklin Barbecue in Austin, Texas. Franklin Barbecue came onto the scene just a few years ago. Right now he's getting lines that are 2 to 3 hours long waiting for the barbecue.
Wow.
You have a couple of options there. You can wait in line, or you can plan ahead and do a call-in order. They only take a small amount of call-in orders every day, where you come pick up the meat basically before they open. Tell them what day you're coming, order at least 5 pounds of meat, and you can skip the line.
All right, so for a northerner, a Yankee like me, when I go to a barbecue place, how am I supposed to know that it's great?
Well, you read Texas Monthly. But, now, there are a few things to look for. I mean, when you get out of your car, the first thing you want to smell smoke. Even if that fire went out a couple of hours ago, if they're burning wood every day, you're going to smell some smoke. Also, when you go inside the place, the best thing is to order directly from the guy cutting your meat or the girl cutting your meat. You can direct them on what cuts you want, on whether the brisket they've got out there looks kind of old and you want a fresh one. If they're going to try and scrape the fat off the top, you can maybe stop them from desecrating the brisket in such a way.
How often do you eat barbecue?
Oh, I would say about 5 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah,
I can't see you, but does it show, or are you able to hide it?
Well, I can't say that I was tiny when I started, but I haven't gotten any tinier.
That's Daniel Vaughn speaking with us last summer. His book is called The Prophets of Smoked Meat, A Journey Through Texas Barbecue. Let us know your favorite barbecue spot. Maybe it's your own backyard grill at hereandnow.org.
Technology companies are quietly chasing the holy grail of the information age, quantum computing. They're working to build a computer powerful enough to solve complex mathematical riddles or sort through the universe of data that's collected about all of us. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WHYY's Todd Bookman explains the challenges.
Before getting too high-tech, let's go back to 1938. A brilliant physicist, an Italian named Ettore Majorana, withdraws all his money from a bank and boards a boat. Then, somewhere between Palermo and Naples, he vanishes without a trace.
Majorana disappeared, and a lot of theories, a lot of speculations have been made. What can I say? The answer hasn't been found.
This is fellow Italian Lorenza Viola, a Dartmouth College physics professor. She researches what's come to be known as the Majorana particle. The year before his disappearance, Majorana published a paper theorizing a revolutionary concept, that there was something out there that could be both a particle and its own antiparticle at the same time, a quasi-particle floating around in the subatomic world. Decades later, scientists have come to believe these properties would make it a good base for a quantum computer. Today's digital computers are built around bits, all the zeros and ones that run our machines. The idea behind a quantum computer is that instead of bits, you have qubits, which can be a zero or a one or basically both at the same time. The problem is, so far, the qubits researchers have identified keep falling apart when put into action. Viola says the Majorana, because of its peculiar qualities, may hang together.
The fact that once created, once identified, it would be harder to destroy them, and so they would be intrinsically more stable, more protected, and so potentially more useful in a qubit. I don't know if it makes sense, but that's the idea.
At this point, the Majorana is still mostly theory. In 2012, a team of Dutch researchers came the closest to proving its existence. But if someday finally harnessed, researchers will face a second challenge, getting it to do the computer operations they want it to. UPenn physics professor Charles Kane says that will require a concept called braiding. The Majorana particles get braided together into patterns to maximize their power.
What I want you to imagine is a square dance party where the two-dimensional plane is the dance floor and the particles are the dancers. And the caller tells you to do a do-si-do. So that means you move around your partner.
All join hands in the center, fall and up once more for the good of the hall. Then swing your partner, swing them all, then promenade around the hall.
The way that a quantum computer accomplishes a computation is by making the quasi-particles dance around each other.
Huge sets of data get tossed into the qubits, which dance and compute and then spit out the answers. Math problems that would stump the computers of today could be worked out in short order, including factoring numbers with hundreds of digits. Professor Kane says right now, researchers are still at the early stages, working to tame the systems.
It's a very difficult problem. You have to understand your materials and you have to have control over them. And that's requiring sort of real state-of-the-art technology.
That's got companies and academics like Dartmouth's Lorenza Viola still combing over the physics Ettore Majorana first put forward 75 years ago, before his mysterious disappearance.
I think if he could see us or somehow be here, he would be very pleased because certainly he's left a big legacy.
And who knows, maybe in another 75 years, Majorana will be a household name.
For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
It's Here and Now.
Some officials, who we don't even know how they got chosen in the first place, are telling us Hong Kong people, this place is Beijing's turf. Today, I have to tell you this is definitely not true. Hong Kong is Hong Kong people's own turf.
That sound of a student protester at a huge rally yesterday in Hong Kong, courtesy of Arirang News. Some of the reaction to an announcement from China over the weekend that it is ruling out open nominations of candidates for running for the top government job in Hong Kong in its first elections in 2017. Instead, candidates will need the support of 50% of a nominating committee to run in the election, and just two or three will be selected. Hong Kong, as we know, is a former British colony which was handed back to China in 1997 under a promise that it would retain certain freedoms not afforded to people in mainland China. Well, today in Hong Kong, a speech by a top Chinese official who was trying to explain that decision on nominations of candidates was interrupted by protesters. Reporter Francis Moriarty of the Foreign Correspondents Club joins us from Hong Kong. And Francis, what is the significance of what happened today?
The significance is that you're going to see a period of time, who knows how long, in which people who want democracy in Hong Kong, including members of the legislature, who are consider themselves pan-democrats, as they're called, are going to begin engaging in a series of actions under the general theme of non-compliance. That could mean boycotting classes by students and teachers. It could mean legislators not taking part in certain activities in the legislature, or perhaps even filibustering. It could mean street actions. And ultimately, the threat of Occupy Central, and in the United States, of course, I think, you know, Occupy Wall Street, et cetera, does not need much explanation.
Right. And we've seen the Occupy Central protests flare up from time to time over the last few months. How much anger is there in Hong Kong toward China right at this moment?
There's a great deal of anger among the people who want democracy, among a significant portion of the population that either supports China or thinks that very pragmatically, that China at the end of the day holds all the cards, so you just better learn how to get with the program. There would be less anger. But the community is really divided. Everything is at risk of being repetitive. It's very divisive right now in Hong Kong, whether it's name-calling or protests or Occupy Central or anti-Occupy Central. The feelings are really increasing in ardor and dividing further along the scale. And China's decision basically to say, take it or leave it, you will get what we call one man, one vote, but you're not going to get really any choice in who the candidates are, has really set people off. But I can't say that people are entirely surprised by that decision.
Well, and we heard some of that anger today in these protests, and some of the protesters stood on chairs and pumped their fists. They were waving signs that said shameful and loss of faith. Here's one of them speaking to the BBC.
The Beijing regime tried to devastate what they have promised for the Hong Kong people, one country, two system. I think universal suffrage means there should be no censorship on the candidates on any election.
And remind us, Francis Moriarty, of what China exactly promised to let Hong Kong do when it comes to elections.
If you go back and look at statements that were made before the handover, that is to say, before the return of Hong Kong from British sovereignty to Chinese sovereignty, you will see that there were statements made by senior Chinese officials responsible for Hong Kong who said the matter of democracy will ultimately be up to the people of Hong Kong. The mainland government, that's to say Beijing, would not interfere. This was a matter entirely for Hong Kong to sort out for itself. What has happened is progressively Hong Kong has not been allowed to sort it out for itself. The mainland has taken a heavier role and a stronger hand. And recently, in its decision a couple of days ago, just said basically, we will choose who the candidates will be according to our process. And at the end, you will get to choose between two and possibly three candidates who will have gone through a process that we find suitable, so that at the end of the day, there would be no surprises that would face Beijing when the time comes to confirm that person as the chief executive of Hong Kong.
So where do you see this headed?
It's not headed any place really good. You just really have a conflict of the force versus the immovable object. China's convinced that it has the horses. It's got all the power. It has reminded Hong Kong repeatedly that China is a unitary state. There are no policies or powers that are reserved to Hong Kong. Any powers that it has come from the Central People's Government. And it has reminded people of that repeatedly. And it's also reminded them that were there to be unrest, the chief executive under the basic law, which is our constitutional document, has the authority, should he wish to call in the PLA to quest to push down any unrest. The PLA is, of course, the People's Liberation Army, which was called in 1989 in Beijing. So that memory is very much in people's minds.
How much worry, though, is there on the part of Beijing that doing what it appears to be doing with Hong Kong and putting a tighter control on freedom there may hurt the economy and one of the most important financial centers in the world, certainly in China?
They see it the other way around. they have made it very clear that one of the reasons that democracy must move very slowly and according to their own schedule in Hong Kong, and of course it would not be democracy in any case, as you and I and many other people would understand it, is because they have to defend the rich. They say that when China changed its constitution in 1982, it promised to defend the interests of all people in China. That's basically when it jettisoned socialist ideology. So that means they have to, in their view, defend the ultra-wealthy and the tycoons who are so important to Hong Kong's economy. And officials have said that if those people were to pull out their investments and leave Hong Kong or take them elsewhere, the damage to Hong Kong would be incalculable. Therefore, in order to please them and keep them happy and keep them investing their money, democracy must move at this snail's pace.
Francis, is it at all risky for you to talk to us about what's going on there?
I feel no fear. The worst thing they could do to me, other than I can't imagine what they would do. But I think that, free speech is not yet so endangered in Hong Kong. It's getting to be in shorter and shorter supply in the general media, which are moving in one direction. A lot of people who are columnists have been asked to stop their columns, or their columns simply haven't been published. In some cases, their columns have been edited to indicate something other than what they intended when they wrote it. So, yes, there's an erosion of press freedom in Hong Kong. But I don't personally feel any fear. Nonetheless, that said, we have had newspaper publishers beat up on the street. And we, of course, had the savage attack on Kevin Lau, the former editor of the Mingpo newspaper here,
right,
who was knifed to within a few centimeters of his life.
Reporter Francis Moriarty, who's also a correspondent governor of the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong. Francis, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's here and now.
Look, Screech, it's no use. We've searched everywhere for that crown.
Yeah, everywhere except the janitor's closet.
Shoinks! That's exactly where I hid it. The janitor's closet. It's gone. Maybe you threw it out with the trash. To the dumpster.
And right now, I bet some of you are having a Pavlovian desire to reach for a bowl of cereal and turn on the TV, which thousands did from 1989 to 93 to watch Saved by the Bell, the escapades of a group of California high schoolers and their principal. And thousands still watch reruns and blog and tweet about them and about the new Lifetime movie airing tonight based on the series. Many are not happy. It turns out the moral of the TV show might have been, be careful how you treat the nerd because he might write a tell-all book that becomes a movie. NPR's media critic Eric Deggans is here. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Were you one of those sitting in front of the TV on Saturday?
No.
No. Okay.
I'm a little older than that generation that grew up with Saved by the Bell.
Look, there are people in our office who are, shouting out lines and characters. It's prompting something in people of a certain age. What was the pull of this show? What was it about?
Well, every generation, I think, has a few sitcoms that they grew up with. So there are people who came of age as this show was airing, and they bonded emotionally with the show in a way that was way beyond whether it was any good or not. So, just like you have people who are fans of a show like, say, Gilligan's Island, and
right.
I know I'm probably going to get a bunch of letters, but Gilligan's Island wasn't necessarily the best sitcom in the world, but people bonded emotionally with it because they saw it at a time when they were coming of age. Saved by the Bell is the same way. And also you had a lot of actors on the show who went on to do other things, like Mark Paul Gosselaar on NYPD Blue, Mario Lopez, who's on Extra, Tiffany Amber Thiessen, Elizabeth Berkley, and even Leah Remini was on the show at one time. So people have grown up with these stars. They've seen them go on to other things, and it produces some nostalgia.
But then there's Dustin Diamond, who played Screech and wrote a tell-all book, Behind the Bell. He's the executive producer of this film that's coming. There are young actors playing all the characters in the original show. In this scene from the film, Zach, the hunky lead in the TV series, starts things off, but Screech, the nerd, cuts in and makes it clear this isn't that Saved by the Bell.
Time out.
Not bad. Guess they like us. Wasn't always like this, though. Saved by the Bell was a wild ride. We almost didn't
Wait a second. Just stop, okay?
Whoa. You can't do that.
Yeah, I can. This time, it's not all about you. This is my story. What really happened behind the scenes of America's favorite Saturday morning show. At least it's the way I remember it. And I was there from the very first episode to the very last.
Okay, so we have Screech sort of taken over here. That's going to be hard for some people.
Well, what's really weird about this is that Dustin Diamond has had a very troubled past, number one. He's had his brushes with the law. He was even involved in pornography for a while. And he has admitted that his biography, Behind the Bell, was exaggerated by a ghostwriter. And so it has stuff in it that may not even be true. But this movie was a product of that book, and he's involved as an executive producer. So we have this weird, unauthorized movie that may be filled with a bunch of stuff that's not even true. And Mark Paul Gosselaar and some other people who've appeared on the show have said that they had positive experiences on the show. They don't recall some of the negative stuff that has been talked about in the book and in the movie. And so we have this weird movie that I think is a product of our post-reality TV age, where even fans of the show know there's probably a lot in this movie that's not true, but they want to believe it, and they want to see behind the scenes, and they want to believe that there's something sordid that went on behind the scenes. So they're going to watch this movie and kind of laugh at it and emotionally kind of bond with it, even though intellectually they know that it's the product of this really sort of flawed book and flawed person.
Well, for instance, we're not sure if, as is depicted in the new Lifetime movie, all the characters fought during a cast photo shoot. Let's listen.
You're such a
Dustin! Language!
You want to say that to my face? Oh, is that supposed to scare me? Because it doesn't.
You shut up.
So, Eric, this is definitely not the show people saw when they were little kids on Saturday morning.
No.
He's painting this picture.
No.
And again, we don't know if this is true.
Yeah, well, what's really interesting about this project is that on the one hand, you've got people who are very nostalgic for the show itself, so they'll show up to watch that. On the other hand, you have people who want to believe that there was very sordid goings on behind the scenes, and they'll show up to see that. And then on the third level, you have people who just like to watch awful made-for-TV movies. And so I told one person about this movie, and they said, this is my Sharknado, which is that sci-fi movie that was purposefully bad. It was bad on purpose. And I think Lifetime has also created a movie that's kind of bad on purpose. It has this weird, sordid past to how it got made. It's telling a story that we don't even know is true. And it's starring a bunch of kids who weren't even alive when the show was on the air. It's just this big sort of ball of really questionable pop culture trends all coming together in one big movie. And for some people, that is really irresistible.
Well, and for Dustin Diamond, it's a chance for him to reshape. I mean, it's really quite interesting. Screech was kind of the word says it all, the name says it all. He was kind of the nerdy guy, and Zach, as we said, was the hunk. Now he gets to make a movie, and in it, Screech looks like the tough guy. Zach's a ladies' man, Lisa and Kelly fighting over him. Here's a clip of Screech, the new Screech in the new movie, getting into a fight.
You know what? You're even weirder looking in person. He's probably the only one on the show not getting any. Who's that? Your boyfriend? Why don't you just shut up? He's gonna make me screech? You? You're a joke.
I am not Screech!
Oh!
Right. So that scene was basically the guy who Dustin Diamond and a friend of his were online at a movie theater, and somebody started heckling him, and so then he beat him up. And, you get this sense that Dustin Diamond, if you know his history, he has struggled to reconcile how he feels about the show. Like, he felt that Screech was a very limiting sort of character for him, and he tried to reject it. Like I said, he did some very explicit things, porn and stuff like that, and now he's come full circle, and he's trying to exploit his connection to the show again and stay in show business. And it's odd because the other people who appeared on the show had much more successful show business careers. And so I don't think they have had that struggle to reconcile their image from the show and what they're doing now the way he has. So imagine if you were in Little League, or if you had played on a soccer team, and the person who had the worst experience on the team created a TV movie about it. That's what seems to have happened here.
the thing to take away from this is if you were sitting in 1989 or 90 watching this show as a kid and now you have kids of your own, you don't want to usher them to the TV to watch this Lifetime movie about this show that you used to love.
Yeah, I would say number one, if you're going to watch it at all, take it with a huge grain of salt because we don't know whether the events that are depicted in this movie actually happened. But the other thing I would say is this shows how nostalgia for an awful TV show can be misused. And, you know, maybe save that nostalgia for a show that was a little better and a little more worthy of your time.
NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Jeremy's jaw just dropped. Defend your show.
Awful TV show? I completely disagree. Saved by the Bell is the greatest.
And
by the way, this thing tonight on
Gone
Lifetime.
With the Wind.
Well, the thing tonight on Lifetime sounds ridiculous slash amazing, but the show Saved by the Bell, give it its credit.
It was the best.
It was the 90s, man. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.